Is anybody from National Treasury here? Oh, yeah. I didn't see. You're sitting next to a man who's dressed like a general, you see. So, welcome to all the members and also the members of the committee. I know you've had a long tour, but in your absence, there's been some very dramatic developments. So, we will have to pick up the pieces and see where things are at the moment. I know the media has been phoning me regularly, wanting updates on all sorts of things and statements, SABC, CENTEC, and departments, and all that. But we will be issuing statements for now. Don't worry, we are back home, and at least we get a proper briefing on some of these developments. Special welcome to the Acting Director General, Dr. Harold Wiesel. Older members of the committee might know that Dr. Wiesel has been a long-standing member of the department, an employee of the department, but he's been for quite some time at the Meraka E-Skills Institute. Is that the right name? The Meraka E-Skills Institute. And the minister has asked him now to stand in because there isn't a direct general in the department at the moment. So welcome to you, special welcome to you, sir, and also to the members of your team. Maybe I'm going to give you, because you are new here, a few moments to say a few words before you hand over to the officials to take us to the post-bank vote. Just in terms of background, if members will remember, at our last meeting when we dealt with the post-bank vote, we had asked the National Treasury and the department to meet with the state law advisors and to effect a number of amendments that the committee had agreed to. So today we were expecting a report on that. And there were two or three grey areas that we wanted further thought on. There is a letter from the minister which I think has been circulated to the members. And I think there's a reworked bill which incorporates a number of the suggestions and amendments that we had proposed. So I suppose later on the officials will take us through the bill with all the amendments. From a committee program point of view, we would want to try and finalize whatever amendments we want to make today so that next week we can at least process the bill and approve it as a committee. I hope it's possible. If not, then we might have to, you know, spend another week on it. But we've been sitting on this bill for quite some time. It's a complex bill. Not because we are lazy or we don't understand, but it's a very complex bill. And there's been a lot of discussion and debate about its governance structure and the governance model and those kinds of things. So, but we're hoping that by today we can begin to finalize the matter. So that's really the objective. If not, then as I said, we'll delay it for another week or two. Dr. Wiesel, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, honorable members. Just a little bit of context and background. I was asked to stand in as acting DG on the 23rd of July, not knowing that I will find myself on a sinking ship. I do, however, believe that it is salvageable with the support and vision and leadership of the PCC and the hard work of the senior managers in the Department of Communications. The Department of Communications at this point in time, and I think it's important that members will understand this, is characterized by what I would say a total collapse of staff morale, and also a almost like total absence of a collective sense of purpose due to many things that have happened over the past six or so months. I think it's also important for members to understand that the DOC delivery system has been severely weakened due to the irrational deployment of staff to positions for which they either don't have the intellectual capacity and or the appropriate skills and competencies. And I think what we have to do in the immediate and short term is to rebuild a department that is so important in view of our role in South Africa in terms of building the information society and knowledge economy, in terms of ensuring that we put in place the appropriate infrastructure that will give people access to modern technologies. But I think more than that, to also ensure that we get our people in this country to take up ICTs and to use it effectively. And in order to do that, I think we also have to have a serious focus on e-skilling our nation. So I think that it's within that context that we need to rebuild the Department of Communications and providing a collective vision and purpose to deliver on our strategic plans. And again, I'm looking forward to the visionary leadership of this committee that I think is very important at this point in time. So, Chairperson, then, just to briefly introduce what we're supposed to be doing here today, and that is to put in front of you a reworked bill, a post-bank bill. And as you know, Postbank is a financial services division of post offices around the world. Their main aim is to give mostly isolated communities access to vital financial and related services and thereby contribute to the economic and social development agenda of the country. And I think that is of fundamental importance in view of delivery or on the to deliver on the medium-term strategic framework as well. Now, this bill that we will put will present here today is also presented against the backdrop of the 1998 white paper on postal policy. I think it's important that we have that context.
I think, Chairperson, if we can allow us just to ask a few questions on the introductory remarks, because I think they're quite serious allegations. And Dr. also expressed the wish that hopefully with the cooperation with the Portfolio Committee Communications, we can address some of the issues and before the presentation of the bill.
Okay. There's a request that we allow for some comments. I don't think that's a problem. I mean, I think when we were all abroad, when we got the news of the dismissal of the former DG, it took a lot of us by surprise. We don't have the full information before us. We've read all the press articles and allegations have been made and counter-allegations. But I mean, these are, I think, the long and short of it are really two or three things. One is that there seems to be a dispute between the minister and DG around powers and functions and roles and responsibilities. That's one area that there isn't a common sort of clarity and purpose on. And then there's a set of issues around the actual dismissal process itself and the actual action in which the DG is now, you know, claiming is unfair or not lawful. And that matter, as I understand it, is before the courts. I think even in our informal discussions when we were abroad, I did indicate that if a matter is before court, we should allow it the the court process to unfold, and that we should not intervene at that stage. But, I mean, there are a number of other issues, you know, allegations have been made, etc. So, I thought when I had met with Dr. Visu in the week, and I thought it was important for him to come at least to tell us where we are with this department, because at the moment, you know, there isn't a sense of a leadership. And perhaps from outside, it looks like there's a crisis in the department. And I think he's been kind enough to come before us. I think he's given us his assessment, that's my sense. He's given us his hands-on assessment. He's been there for a week or two, really. He's given us an assessment of the situation. It is a bleak picture from what he says. But I'm going to allow committee members to express their views on the matter. And then I think as a committee, at some point in the near future, we would want, once Dr. Visu has settled down, we would want to call the department in to give us a full briefing on what the state of play in the department. That's a proposal I would want to put forward as the chair. Because, you know, lots of people have been talking about it, asking questions, etc. It's only with accurate information that we are able to make a proper assessment of the department. And of course, we've got an oversight responsibility which we can't run away from. So we must exercise that responsibility. But it can be done on the basis of proper and correct information. So, okay, I'll open it up for a few minutes for members to express their views on what has transpired over the last few weeks. Patricia?
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. Chairperson, like you rightly say, we don't have the full information before us. And my understanding from what you read in the newspapers that performance was certainly never mentioned as one of the reasons for the suspension, dismissal, whatever, of the DD. But I would also like us to look at performance in terms of what is before us. Not so long ago, a couple of months ago, the department presented to us a strategic plan. On our request, we also asked for the operational plan and the business plan. And I think as a committee, we should be judging or critiquing the department based on those documents to our, that is available to us. And that we should request the acting DG to confine himself to what we have got, that we can judge for ourselves, the kind of comments that he's making in another forum, in another meeting, where we can engage with the strategic plan, operational plan, the business plan, and see the 3 months after these documents were presented to Parliament, was there failure to implement those? That is what I would suggest, because I think that we need to be careful as committee members to embroil ourselves in a dispute that really belongs to the department itself, between the acting DG and the last DG. They must sort it out. We must confine ourselves as Parliament to the strategic plan, business plan, operational plans before us.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to ask Dr. Visu, how long would he need to be able to come back to us with a better sense of understanding of the deployments and redeployments and the current situation of staff? You mentioned problems with some of them with not the right skills and competencies, etc. Which of those redeployments were made lawfully, which will be very difficult to change? Sort of a situational analysis, Chairperson, of the staff structure and where he would identify weaknesses and how will the department actually manage to correct some of the wrong decisions that were taken? You know, if could he just give us an indication? At this stage, we understand it is very superficial. He's not been there long. But when will he be able to come back to us with a factual analysis of the structure that must drive a very strategic department? Thank you.
Are you serious, Chair? What must I say?
You raise your hand.
No. Look, Chair. I was trying to ascertain whether we are still having the one item agenda, the informal deliberation of the post-bank bid. If we do, I don't understand this discussion. Where does it lead us anyway? So I will just ask that we just go to the post, the informal deliberation of the post-bank bid, and deal with that. These other things, if they will come, they will have their own time at another arrangement. But I think let's just stick to the informal deliberation. So that we do our business and finish it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's very important what Mr. Kulwani said, that we must carry on with the post-bank bill. But I think listening to the allegations that the acting DG made, I think it and the role of the portfolio committee in future, I think it is very important for us to know exactly what led to this dreadful situation at this stage, and then we can make assessments and try to handle the situation. Thank you.
No, I think we are in agreement that in the very near future we will be calling the department to give us a proper report and the state of clearing the department. It must be very clear what we want the department to do. The acting DG cannot account for the actions of the former DG.
That's a separate matter. That's between the executive and the DG that needs to be sorted out. But we will call the department, the acting DG, and the officials to tell us what. I mean, there's a strategic plan, there's a whole lot of operational programs that are supposed to be rolled out to give us an update on what has happened and if the service delivery has been compromised as has been indicated, what steps are going to be taken to rectify the situation and to make sure that the department can discharge its statutory responsibilities. So we will be calling the department shortly. And it's something that we will sort out between my office and the acting DG's office. Okay, then can we continue with the post bank bill? Dr. Viso, are you handing over to your legal team? Yeah.
Yes, I'm actually. Maybe just introduce people
again. There's some new faces, I think.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to introduce the team that is here today. Is Mr. Gift Buthelezi, Acting DDG Policy Development, Mr. Norman Nsulele, Chief Director in the Policy Branch, Willie Bukela, Director, who will also present the Post Bank Bill here today, and Alf Bilt, Director, Legal Services. Over to you, William.
Yeah, and then from NSNP, we have here Omega Salembe, Acting Chief Director, Janine Bednar Giozzi, Director, and Alvina Taylor.
Thank you. Thank you, Ekindiji Bezo. My role is going to be easy compared to the previous engagement that PCC used to call us for that. So today I'll be doing a very easy job to present what the PCC agreed in the last meeting. Taking into account that in terms of process and way forward, this bill belongs to the PCC now. It's a parliament bill. We only present because we're requested by the PCC to do that. So as I'm saying, my job today is going to be presenting what PCC agreed in the last meeting. Not what DOC wants, not what Treasury wants, not what Postalists want, but what PCC wanted. So I'll be speaking as politician, unfortunately. Because this is a political bill for now. It belongs to them. So DOC, you bear with me. I'm tasked to present on behalf of politicians, so I gather one of them today. Colleagues and honorable members, the last week that we had, remember, we spent almost the whole day bringing in issues that need amendments and further refining by the working committee. That had been done, and the bill, as Honorable Chair just said in his speech, that has been circulated, I guess, as a point of reference. You use that bill, and secondly, the presentation that was made, I guess, has been presented. So these presentations only covered issues raised. I need to emphasize. It only covered issues raised by the PCC. So where PCC has, they can go back and do that. So that's what going to happen. As a point of departure, members, on the definitions, there was an issue that we need to refine, the issue of PFMA. Now, Clause 1 of the bill was amended to ensure that the word as defined in the bill bears the same meaning as in the PFMA. Moving forward, in terms of the definition, the business of the bank was deleted and replaced with the concept banking business wherever it occurs in the bill.
Can we follow this in B2 2010? Can we? Because, I've got the B14209, where we've made a lot of suggestions, and then another one, B2 2010, came out. Which one are we dealing with?
Thank you, Chair. On the definitions, the context said register of banks definition was inserted, and I think members, when they skimmed through their draft final bill, it defined the register of banks as designated under Section 4 of the Banks Act. Moving forward to Clause 2, which an object of the Act, the role of the post bank. as an emphasis to the remainder role of the Post Bank and in line with the consultant's proposals, the following objectives has been added to the bill. I think honourable members should recall last meeting where we spent almost an hour discussing the object of the bill. There is now a sub-clause C which talks about expanding the rate of banking services and developing into a bank of first choice, in particular to rural area, rural and lower income markets, as well as communities that have little or no access to commercial service or facilities. Clause D, promote universal and affordable access to banking services. And the last clause, which is clause E, ensuring that there is the rates and charges of the company must take into consideration the needs of people in the rural and low income markets, as well as communities that have little or no access to commercial banking services or facilities. On this, I would like to emphasize, because there is an emphasis below that submission, which make point of reference to Treasury, and I hope my colleagues from Treasury are here. Treasury is still of the view that paragraph E above is too operational and should possibly be omitted. That's what happened in the last meeting between DOC and Treasury. This is their view. Remember, as DOC, we could not make amendment or omit clause E because, as I said, this bill does not belong to either of us. So they make a point of emphasis. It's upon the colleagues and upon politicians themselves whether they want to omit clause E or to give Treasury an opportunity perhaps to submit further on that regard. The next bullet said the limited role is also strengthened by the Minister's policy making power proposed. This was more emphasized by members in the last meeting.
Why don't we just get the input from Treasury also so that we work in a systematic way?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. We have had an opportunity at this committee to express our view on this matter. We still maintain our view that this clause or sub-clause as it stands, perhaps it talks to operational matters. Our understanding of the object section was that it needs to talk to high-level strategic objectives of what the Post Bank ought to seek to achieve over a longer period of time, rather than to deal with operational specific, in this instance, pricing issues. So that is our future.
Members, can I just ask, in terms of the process, do you want the officials to take us through all the amendments, or do you want to deal with this thing as like we can dispense with this now and take a decision so that we know where we are? Otherwise, we're going to come through the thing again all over. So I don't know, in terms of the procedure. Ms. Hickey?
I think I suggest that the way we are doing it, let's continue the
which means that we take one item and we discuss it.
We discuss it and then
we go on. Okay. Are we comfortable with that? Because we're not voting on the bill, we'll still do that next week. But I think we want to now try and tighten things up and take some sort of provisional decision on this matter. Are we okay with that, Master Lee? No, I think what we are doing now, if you remember our last meeting there in Good Hope, we had made all sorts of suggestions in different clauses. Mm-hmm. And we had asked the team to go and do the legal crafting. So that's what they're reporting on. So as Mr. Vugela indicated, he is now presenting what we had asked them to do. So I want to know from us that if we can now, otherwise we're going to have a long presentation,
And it means we still have to come back again to the same clauses, one by one afterwards. So from a practical point of view, it might be better if we just sort of start agreeing on these things now. Okay, so there's a proposal here that we delete E, because it's too operational and it's not the high-level objective of the bank. Patricia?
Chairperson, the reason why we raised that to come into the object of the bill is to make a distinction between a commercial bank and this bank. And the specific question was, I remember the example I used that when the Reserve Bank cut their rates or they increased the rates, commercial banks all set it at the same level. Will this bank also be affected by it? And I think if we want to make, I don't agree that it's operational. It can be written in a way to show us in the object of the bill the distinction between this bank and a commercial bank.
No, sir. Look, sir, maybe the first issue is that what is operational here? I don't see percentages and amounts. I see wording which is saying broadly. If someone can show me what is operational first, but I don't see any operational issue here. It's a statement which does not put percentages or cap anything, but it's saying broadly this is what it must happen. So it can be at any rate, at any percent, at any time. It does not stop anyone to do anything. But I just don't understand. Maybe if I can be told exactly what is operational. Because I can see that maybe the operational is the description in terms of the issue of ensuring the rates and charges and so on. But again, there's no specific amount and percentage put in this clause. So maybe can be taken through, because I don't understand the operational part of it. How does it come in here? Because the broader statement is that consider these other issues and so on.
Thank you, Chair. In our deliberations with the DOC, we as the Treasury posed a question as to, in practice, what would be the message that the board of the Post Bank and the executives of the Post Bank will be supposed to take out of this provision. It did not quite come out clearly as to exactly what is the practical implication of this clause. The way we look at rates, particularly interest rates in the banking sector, really, we see a double-edged sword in the sense that there are people who will be interested in lower rates, that is those people who are borrowing from the bank, but there are those also who are interested in higher rates, which are the people who are depositing their last-end money into the bank and hoping to earn a better interest. And therefore, on an ongoing basis, really, in a banking situation, there's this balancing act of these two interests. And therefore, we think that is something that needs to be taken into account, rather than that the rates should take into account the needs of the poor, which is outside of this balancing or trade-off between depositing rates and lending rates of the Post Bank.
As I understood, it wasn't just really the user charges that we're really talking about, because commercial banks will fix their rate, supposedly driven by the interest of the shareholders, right, which is to make the bank profitable. Of course, it's providing the service to the public of a kind, but at the end of the day, it's also protecting the interest of the shareholders. Now, I think the point that was made here is that we don't want this to be a typical commercial bank. We want it to be a bank of the poor, in a sense. And therefore, if you have excessive user charges, then you also make it difficult for the poor to access this particular facility. I think that was the argument or the distinction we were trying to make. Mm-hmm. Now, can we capture that in law? I don't know. Nikki?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think what is important here, and I think Patricia also mentioned this whole issue, you know, if we look at Clause E, and charges of the company must take into consideration the needs of the people in the rural areas, etc. What is the meaning in this bill of take into consideration? For me, it means nothing. You can take something in consideration, so what? And then carry on. I think it must be specifically stated, then we all know, and the people who is going to deal with the bank exactly know where they are standing. We can't go through with vague sentences like this. Thank you, Chairperson.
Technical people, can you help us? How can we? You see, if we do what he is suggesting, then we become super. Then it's operation. We want to capture a principle that says that, you know, this is not an ordinary thing. That can just set it straight. It should take into account the needs of the school, particularly those in the urban areas, before it sets it. Our charges are being raised by the unit of consumers. No, no.
What did you say about the poor? The bill? Can you just repeat the chairperson to you?
Hey, what I was stating was the trade-off between the interest of the depositors and the interest of the people who are lending from the bank. There is always that at least a theoretical tension between the two. One group will seek to have as low the interest as possible for the money that they borrow from the bank, and the other group, who are the people who are saving into the bank, would wish to get as high an interest as possible. That is the balance or the equation that needs to be maintained through the interest rate of the bank.
But my question, how does this clause stop that to be balanced? That's my question. How does this clause as it stands stop that balance to be done? That's the issue which I'm interested in. People say it operates that, but I'm saying, how does this clause as it stands now stop that balancing act? Because you see, that's why I was raising the issue, that it has not kept anything. Don't say, don't go this percent, don't go down this percent. Just that a broader issue. But I just don't understand, how does this thing then stop the balancing act as it stands now? That's the issue which I was trying to raise.
I do have more of a problem with the length and the structure. I don't have a problem with the principle of mentioning it. I cannot see that it is operational if you establish an object to say, this bank is a commercial bank, but its object is different. It is really to serve the poor and sort of remote areas, essentially. And therefore, it should take into consideration. That is the difference. So a person who is making a deposit and who wants to have high yields will probably not deposit in this bank if it is a question of earning interest. That is a tight balance. And, I mean, clearly that is going to be the problem for this bank to remain afloat, you see. Because somehow, I think that is going to be the real challenge. I don't think it is wrong to say it, but I think the sentence as it is constructed is very clumsy. Sorry, that's just my opinion. Just to say that ensuring that the rates and charges of the company must take into consideration the needs of people in the lower income market, wherever they are, be they rural, urban, because many of the poor people also now reside in cities. So if we mention rural, then we're actually excluding, well, we're not focusing on the urban poor. So I just believe that we should perhaps bring that closer in. And is it necessary to mention that have little or no access? We clearly know what the object of the bill is, but it's stated in the background document. Do you need to bring it in here in the definitions again? I don't think so. I think it's an object that you can list in this section, but you don't go into too much detail of exactly where they are and where they are situated.
Okay. So if you say something like this, ensuring that the rates and charges of the company must take into consideration the needs of people in the lower income market. So,
take out
no, it must take into consideration.
Ensuring that.
Omega, can the treasury live with that?
Not really, but
ensuring that the rates are In the second month, so it says the company takes into consideration the needs of people in the lower income market, full stop.
Yeah.
Are you okay with that, Ms. Stone?
Yes. Now that we have tried to master this, then yes, it does make sense to me. But I just want to understand from the trainer whether I understood him well when he said the rates are also addressing the needs of the people. Then if you abbreviate, I mean, if you shorten the whole sentence, yes, it's fine for consideration of the lower income market, but does it address the other category? The equilibrium we're talking about.
Chair, the way we read subclause E, really, is that it proposes that rates should be sensitive to low-income people. In other words, rates should be very low when you're dealing with those low-income people. But it does not talk about the very low-income people who are otherwise striving to save and therefore seek to gain as much as possible from their meager saving into the post bank. That is the equilibrium that is not articulated in this clause.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask Treasury, is it really possible if you are trying to create a commercial bank to serve both objects, as you stated? Is it possible? You know, people want more, a bigger interest to gain more money on the, and I'm not understanding. How can you put it into an act that you serve both?
Chairperson, I just went back to the state's vision for the post bank. In the white paper, 9.8.2 says, create a bank of first choice for the lower income group, providing them with appropriate banking products and high quality financial services to the post office network. The other one is also very important, is 9.10. The developmental role placed on the post bank requires that it achieve the status of a fully fledged savings bank. Now, of course, we have debated before where should have savings and lending. But, you know, if we must have in the object of the bill the vision that the state vision that's in the white paper.
Okay, I've got a proposal on the table. Can we live with it? What we want. The one that I said, ensuring that the rates and charges of the company take into consideration the needs of the people in the lower income market. And the needs will be certainly. So, both of
these.
But we've got access in D. Promoting universal and affordable access to the market.
Chair, thank you very much. Honourable Members, I just wanted to also point that if you look at Clause C,
yes,
it speaks to the issues that have been raised by Honourable Member DeLille as in the white paper on the issues that are there. So if you look at E, the last part is in fact a repetition of what we had in on top in C. So if you look at those two clauses, we probably need to rework, if not delete, if the treasurer's request of that issue. Thank you.
All right. Can we agree with the proposal as I have read it up earlier on? Then we are done with clause 2, except that you just need to fix up the A part there, get the typing right. Okay. Going to say something? Take, yes? Mikasa?
Yes, Chair, I just wanted to recall that perhaps all interest rates are governed by the reserve rate. So, can you really say anything about interest rates here?
That's why I'm asking, are the words rates and charges, do they mean the same thing? Do they mean different things?
Yeah, maybe we do need to make a clarity on the issue. The Reserve Bank governs the interest rate that you give. The charges that you have as a bank would be determined by you. There is an issue that you do, and I think what it refers to is the charges that you have as a bank. Yes. If I may do remind that one of the things that we did say is that this bank will also operate under the bank's regulations. What we are very mindful of is exactly the intent of making sure that this bank is in fact affordable to all the users that are there. Now, within the banking regulations, there will be things that will be regulated by the bank that this bank would have to comply to. However, in terms of the charges that you would, let me make an example about, if you find that to deposit an amount of money, you would be charged a particular amount for handling of that deposit. Those are the charges that are referred to that are within the ambit and the power of the bank. However, if the interest rate increases by 0.5%, if the base of what you are going to charge has to increase by that and it's lower, it will still be affordable to people. And I think we shouldn't confuse the two issues, because then when we make the interest rate in this act variable for this, we will then, for me, not comply with the banking regulations, and I think that will be creating a problem.
No, I don't think we should deal with detail now. I think the point raised by Mr. Buthelezi is one which we have to come back, and it was raised the last time by Komesi Kumbuzu. What are we creating? Because there's the Finance Banking Act, there's something bill or somewhere, because this seems to be a hybrid between the two definitions that the state has got already. So we seem to be creating it first and then wait for the Treasury to then define and name it later on. And unless we said so the last time as the members of this committee, unless my personal choice will be that we should wait with this bank until we've got that the Department of Finance or the Treasury define and create another type of bank, because this is a hybrid. It's in between the existing two definitions that we have. And so we will continue arguing to establish a certain type of bank, but based on the principles of a commercial bank. And that's why we're getting these detailed explanations now about... It's just confusing, really.
No, but look, let's not go back to those debates. We have agreed that this bill is desirable. We are proceeding with this bill, but we told ourselves that we must define very clearly what we want.
That's what we're trying to do at the moment. Now, everything that has been said so far, can we live with E as we are suggesting, the amended version of it? Agreed? Thank you very much. We move on. So that you guys will clean it up for us and bring it back nice and clean next week. Clause 3? Section
3 or clause 2? Thanks, Honorable Chair. I'm moving to the next slide. As I said, my job is going to be easy, just to present what committee wants. On the third slide, which is clause 3 in cooperation, the PCC requested the DOC and National Treasurer to look at the alternative proposals on the governance structure of the post bank that will give greater power to the executive authority to intervene in governance matters at the post bank should the needs arise. One alternative mechanism to ensure greater power to the executive is to make the minister the shareholder in the Kapan Post Bank. Now, on the very same clause, Chairperson, the state law advisor was consulted for opinion and they provided their views on the legal implications of the minister being the shareholder. It's a post African Post Office as the bill currently provides in clause 3.2. Clause 3.2, Chair, it reads thus, the post office shall, upon incorporation of the company, be sole member of the shareholder of the company. Now, subsequent to that request and of the opinion of the SLA, they provided the following opinion. One, if the minister is the shareholder, the post bank is no longer a subject of the post office, and the post office has no relationship with the post bank. It must be kept in mind that the post office is a wholly owned state enterprise, that if the post office remains the shareholder of the post bank, the state, in effect, the minister, that is in question, will be able, through the post office, to hold the post bank accountable for any of its actions. Furthermore, honorable members, the post office is a major public entity listed in Schedule 2 of the Public Finance Management Act, 99 Act No. 1, and must comply with all the requirements of that act related to the public entities. Now, in terms of the same schedule, any subsidiary of entity under the ownership control of the post office is also a public entity. That similarly to the post office, the post bank will have to comply with the Public Finance Management Act. Paragraph 5.1.15.2 of the Protocol on Corporate Governance also provides that the directors of the wholly owned state-owned enterprise are required to keep the credit authority informed of their operation of the SOE and its subsidiaries, and to give the executive authority such information in relation to those operations as the authority may require from time to time. The said protocol applies to all public entities, such as the post office, and any subsidiaries of such public entities. Now, if the minister becomes the shareholder, the bill will have to be scrutinized for any unintended consequences. For example, clause 9 of the bill that seeks to authorize the person to render e-services through the fiscal assets, systems, employees, and general infrastructure of the post office. The provision was drafted based on the fact that the post bank is a wholly owned subsidiary of the post office. The post office will have to be given an opportunity to respond should the possible change of ownership post bank be considered by the committee. If I may continue, honorable members, The Jewish National Treasury Scheme is not in favor of establishing the Post Bank as an independent state-owned enterprise. At this stage, for the reasons indicated above, and prefer the current structure in the bill that creates the Post Bank as subsidiary of the Post Office. The current governance structure will allow the sufficient power of the executive to intervene. Furthermore, the policy and regulatory power in Clause 25, as per the request of members, further empowers the minister to guide the Post Bank where necessary. Members, as suggested during the PC meeting of the 18 May 2010, provision has also been made in Clause 14 for the two members of the Post Board of the Board of the Post Office to serve as members of the Board of the Post Bank. The minister further remains responsible for the appointment and removal of the members of the board, and in view of the discussion between the DOC and Treasurer and SLA, the governance structure in the attached revised bill is proposed, retaining the post office post bank subsidiary relationship. I pause.
All right. So the advice we're getting from everybody is that we keep the post bank as a subsidiary of the post office, and that the minister remains an indirect shareholder. Mr. Kulwani?
Chair, I've been listening carefully on the motivation. And the recommendation by the DOC and the National Treasury. But to be honest, Chair, the reason given, some of them, I find it difficult to believe them or to be convinced by some of the reasons are provided. For argument's sake, there's the fact that if the post office is separate from the post bank, still anyway companies, they do engage in negotiation and have agreement of operation and so on. It doesn't matter whether it's a subsidiary or not. That can still happen. I'm saying under normal doing course of business, that's possible to happen. Does not need necessarily that you need to be subsidiary to do that. But I'm saying, Chair, the issue which I want to check here is that if we move the direction which has been suggested, you see what Honorable Member Mastori said now comes in, because this explanation touches a lot of sections which we are not yet now, but it touches those sections. But the first thing which I would like just to be made to understand is that if the Post Bank is a subsidiary for Post Office, and you keep on saying the minister must appoint the board of the subsidiary company, what does that mean practically? That's what I'm saying. I just want to understand that. Because to me, if you say it's a subsidiary of Post Office, it means the appointment of the board, logical, of the board and other issues attached should be done by Post Office Board. To me, maybe I'm a lay person, I don't understand the law, but I'm saying if it's a subsidiary for the Post Office, everything else must be done by Post Office in that Post Bank was its subsidiary. I just want to understand how does it make it possible then that the minister can still go and remove the board members of the Post Bank. I understand that the minister owns Post Office. But here, as a matter of a legal issue, is that the Post Bank owns the Post Office owns the Post Bank. Then the minister is the shareholder, one shareholder, and so on. I just want to understand that, whether that makes sense. That Post Office owning the Post Bank, but the minister still go and remove, go and appoint, go and intervene, and I don't see the role of Post Office in those clauses. Most of those clauses, when I go through, there's no role of Post Office. The minister going can remove, can appoint, but Post Office on the appointment then can be concurrency or understanding and so on. I just want to check whether it's not clumsy. Are we not coming something which is clumsy, and if there are other maybe authorities, Chair, where we can research. Because I've tried to go through it, but I don't see the role of Post Office, which is the main owner of a post bank, which has come in clearly on some of this provision and so on. The minister comes in. That's the first thing, Chet, which I just want to be clarified, whether is it possible, are we not doing something which is clumsy in terms of this bill and so on, or we have to accept that if the subsidiary for post office have a more say on the post bank, of course the minister will influence because of post office. But it can be both. I'm just trying to check the both part of it, whether it can be both. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks, Honorable Member Polwane, for that question. You know, when we started, we said this is a PCC legislation. And I want to bring that on forward, Chair. This is what the PCC said once. If you remember the previous two meetings, where the post office playing a very meaningful role. And the very same PCC said, no, the process is too long. Give minister powers on this area. Our role, members, was to go back and reconcile what PCC wanted. We had views that presented with treasury and post office. The scenario sitting today in the bill, it was after a lengthy discussion of the meeting of the 18 May 2010 that took almost a whole day. And we were given mandate to execute a DOC treasury team.
No, Chair. Maybe so that we don't waste time. I know what the PCC said. The issue I'm raising here is that you sat down, there's a clause here where you are saying as the National Treasurer and DOC, you want the route or you prefer the route of Post Bank being a subsidiary of Post Office. But there's something here which is written there. Now, I'm saying, Chair, it's normal cause that immediately you reach that, it's got consequences on other issues. You cannot reach that and say, anyway, the PCC said, because at that time when we discussed the matter, we were not in that conclusion. Now we've come with another conclusion, but you don't want to deal with the other consequences, which were not part of the initial issue we made. So I'm saying if you reach that conclusion, you must be able to explain, I understand it's our view, but you should be able to explain what then becomes the consequences on the other clauses. That's the issue I'm raising. But I understand that what we said and so on, but I don't see it yet that we have considered that moving forward. You have only dealt with that and say, you know, should be the subsidiary of post office. But moving forward, you remain with the clauses as they are, which put the minister dealing with everything without indicating what post office must. I'm just trying to get the sense of that. That's the issue I'm trying to raise.
But let me see if I can help here. If you look at clause 10.2, it does take into account the issue that has been raised by Mr. Polwane, because the appointment of the board is by the minister, but with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance and the post office. So it's not a unilateral decision of the minister now. It has to be done with the concurrence of another minister and, I suppose, the board of the post office. So I think your question has been covered in that one. But you see, the issue is the policy choice that is being suggested to us. And I think we must either we accept that policy advice that, look, it's best in the near future to keep the post office as a subsidiary of the post office. Now, we know Johnny DeLange has been very sharp on this one, saying that, look, we can't get a few board members, both of the post office and of the post bank, determining fundamental policy, putting at risk, lending money, borrowing money, taking loans all over the world, etc. And then when that bank collapses, the state must be the guarantee, the guarantor. Is that the right word? Right? And then only the minister comes in. So he says, what's the power of the government to determine what happens over the bank? But the advice that is being given to us is that the indirect method is still a proper method or an effective method, with the provision that is a clause 25, I think, as a safeguard that you have introduced, that will still give ministers significant power in determining the overall policy of the bank. So those are the two safeguards that have been put in, as far as I can understand what has happened here. Now, do we accept that policy position that the bank should remain a subsidiary? I think the overall advice we're getting, even from National Treasury,
is that it might be premature to set it up as an independent bank on its own. Okay, Mr. Kulani?
Sir, you see the chapter you are referring to, you see, church, read the entire bill in its current form. You go to the removal of the board members and other things, there's no role for post office. That the issue I'm raising is that, say, if we accept that policy change, what becomes the consequence of that? Because that's the issue I'm raising, because we don't see post office featuring, if you read the other chapters. I'm asking the consequence of that, because what you mean is becoming under post office. But when you read the chapter of removal and the other things, only the minister. I'm saying that logical, because I don't want us to deal with something with later public were criticized that they were not thinking and so on. That's the issue I'm raising. So I read almost the entire thing. So I'll say somewhere post office got no role at all. So only the minister who got their role and so on. But it's a subsidiary of post office.
Okay, can we note that? I think as we move on clause by clause, can we just keep this question in mind? What do we foresee as the role of the shareholder in this case, the post office? Right. Can we keep that question right in front of us as we go through each clause? We might not be able to answer everything now. Okay. Are we comfortable then with clause 3 as is? Because there are no proposed amendments. Agreed? Good. 4?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Clause 4, insertion of the bank. In light of the pending dedicated bank legislation that Treasury is still working on, which the post bank could be registered under, as the purpose of this process, clause 4 is amended to provide for the post bank to be registered in terms of that application legislation, applicable legislation. Clause 4, 1, notwithstanding Section 15 of Banks Act or corresponding provision in any other sub legislation in terms of which company must restart in the care of its operation, the company must restart as having been authorized to form a company in terms of the Companies Act. On Clause 4, 2, the company must, in contact with the Minister and Minister of Finance, be registered in terms of legislation as an institution of conduct banking business after it has satisfied the requirement for registration in terms of such legislation. It has further straight down to say, notwithstanding Section 43 of the Banks Act or a corresponding provision in any other applicable legislation in terms of which company must be registered and carry on its operations, the post office is not required to register as a controlling company of the company, and the appointment of the board of the post office is not subject to the approval of the register of banks. A provision was further inserted in clause 4.3 as read to exempt the post office to register as a controlling company of the post bank for the purpose of section 43 of the Banks Act, and that the appointment of the post office board is not subject to the approval of the register of banks. I pause.
Right. Lindy? Do we understand this? I see you all looking baffled.
Yeah.
Lindy?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about, I'm very glad to see this, the insertion of the dedicated bank legislation. From my understanding, there seems to be a choice here. Because once the bank bill is passed into law, there will be both a dedicated bank act and a banking act. Who decides whether or not the post bank remains in the Banks Act or transfers over to dedicated bank? Because it says that the company must, in consultation with the minister and the minister of finance, be registered in terms of the applicable legislation. Who decides on what the applicable legislation is once we have two acts? What's to prevent the post bank from remaining subject to the Banks Act more commercially if the minister and the finance minister decide that's what suits them? Is there no way we can compel it to switch over to dedicated banks once that law is passed?
I think the bill has been passed as it is, as the Honourable Lindy was raising it. It doesn't preclude any amendment in terms of what you require. So if you feel that, no, you're at the point where you need to shift to other benefits that are found in the dedicated bank, as the clauses that define it, what you want, you do. Yeah, you can actually put in an amendment. It's done in any legislation anyway. If there are changes in the area, then you just make an amendment to that. The particular amendment you require. Yeah.
Patricia?
Chairperson, since we've got Treasury here, can they tell us by when will the dedicated bank legislation be before Parliament? And is there any rush in getting this bank established now before that legislation, dedicated legislation, comes before Parliament? Maybe just give us some information how far the piece of legislation is.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Member. In terms of our internal strategic scheduling of the legislation, we say it shall be presented to Cabinet before the end of the financial year, which is before the end of March next year. It will then be submitted to Parliament immediately thereafter. The question has been posed before as to 2011. The question has been posed before as to whether we need not consider delaying this post-bank bill then in anticipation of the post-bank, in anticipation of the dedicated bank legislation. Our response at the time, and which remains our response now, is that there is a lot of work that needs to be done before the post-bank is ready to register as a bank anyway. And therefore, to delay this will just be postponing that amount of work that needs to be done in incorporating the company called Postbank before it can register as a dedicated bank or as a commercial bank if we do not have the dedicated bank legislation. So we felt that in the final analysis, really, the fact that the dedicated bank is coming behind the Postbank bill is not a major transmash. We will catch up at one point or the other, and these will be synchronized ultimately. Thank you.
I just wanted to know the Dedicated Banks Act. I suppose it will cater for such institutions as the Land Bank and similar institutions. Then you'll have a sort of almost a support role from the part of the state. So can we then, because this is a bank that is dedicated for the unbanked, can we then work from the premise that we basically understand that the post bank will be built under the dedicated bank rather than under the commercial, where it will be competing in a commercial bank sector in the economy? The reason why it is just important is that it may guide the rest of the measures that we actually instituted. We've had severe challenges to some of these institutions in the past, and we must make sure that we actually almost anticipate that. So maybe we're actually writing a piece of legislation on behalf of Treasury now, of what an institution would be like when it is to resort under the dedicated bank.
Look, well, let's not go into. I think what we're doing here is we're creating provision for the bank to be covered under another act when that act is assented to. Well, we're only creating flexibility. And the choice, I suppose, will be a choice of the shareholder and the government where they would want to locate.
Not the people.
No, not the portfolio committee. We've got no controlling power over this bank. It's the board and the shareholder and the minister who will then decide that really this bank needs to be located under the new act or the current bank act.
And I mean, not the PTC in the process.
No, as far as this creates the opportunity and the flexibility, but the decision is not a decision for the PCC.
Thank you, Chair. I think this clause represents a major trade-off between ourselves and Treasury, because remember we insisted in the beginning it should be registered under the Banks Act, and Treasury said, no, it must be under the Dedicated Banks Bill because it's a type of bank under that bill. And we had a problem with that because there's no guarantee, with the greatest respect to Treasury, that that bill will ever be passed. It's been in the running for many years. So does it mean we will have to wait potentially, again with respect, for another 5 years before we can continue with the government policy in the white paper, which was to do what we're doing now? So we can't put everything in the hands of this bill, which is to be promulgated at some future date. And therefore, we started, and Treasury intervened, and we said, well, what do we do now? Treasury said, refer to the Dedicated Banks Bill. We said, and the State Law Advisor concurs, you cannot do that. You cannot, in a law, refer to a bill. It doesn't exist. It doesn't have any legislative power. So we couldn't take that position. So then we started, the committee mandated us to go back and find a solution. And we've spent hours and hours debating this issue, let me promise, honorable members. And I think we've agreed that we have something that's workable now. Because the current structure still gives the power to the Minister of Finance, because his concurrence is required, to at the end of the day insist that we wait for the Dedicated Banks Bill to become an act and that registration takes place in terms of that act. He has that power. But at the same time, our minister would have the power to say, but Minister of Finance, that bill is not coming. I've been waiting 3 years now, and this is not fair. Government policy dictates that we proceed with this bank, so let's register in terms of the Banks Act. So this position gives some power to both the respective ministries and enables the post bank to actually be registered at some point of time. There's one alternative way of doing it, which is to simply in our bill at this stage refer to the Banks Act, right? Registration in terms of the Banks Act. Then Treasury should, when they bring the Dedicated Banks Bill, in the schedule to that bill, they amend our Post Bank Act and they say, we are now amending Banks Act to Dedicated Banks Act. So in that way, they still have, that's just an alternative mechanism. It puts sort of the power in the hands of then the Portfolio Committee on Finance. But this current wording also works equally well. We respectfully submit, Chair.
Can I just understand correctly? If you register in terms of the Bank Act, the current Bank Act, what are the type of banks prescribed in that act that you can register under? Is the one you can register as a commercial bank? Is there another type of bank that you can register under the current Banks Act? What type of bank is it? Is there another type of bank? Or does the Banks Act just make provision for the establishment of commercial banks? So if the problem is saying that they are going to register this bank in terms of the existing Banks Act, which only makes provision to register commercial banks, then what are we dealing with here? What do we call this? Because we've agreed in some way that there need to be a hybrid between commercial bank and what we attempted in terms of the same white paper. This white paper doesn't say that you must register a bank under the existing Bank Act and register a commercial bank. That's not what the white paper is saying.
No, Chair. Maybe we must proceed, Chair. You say, Chair, we will always go back because we are dealing with something difficult. So, believe me, we're still going to spend more hours again dealing with the same bill. If we have things that we have spent a lot of hours, because not an easy thing to deal with. I think something which honorable member said is putting the cart before the horse, another and so on. But Chair, the issue is that I think the problem, it also comes when we said the object is to establish a bank with a certain different kind of vision. As we are dealing with with this bill. And then you say it's up to the executive to decide whether it's become a commercial or something else. We seek to defeat what we are trying to deal with and so on. I think we should be clear on that. Well, that's what brings the confusion. Immediately you say, no, it's not up to this PCC to delete that, it's only the executive that determine the shareholders, and so what does that mean? That's why you see a lot of questions outstanding. Well, that statement on its own is to say we're wasting time. Anyway, things can happen without this thing going through, without us and so on. So I think that statement is a problem. To alter it in this manner. So that's why the questions are coming. But the issue Chair was going at was that, of course, because it's difficult, we will always be between the commercial and what is coming, which we don't know. But I think that's the reality we must live with, so that we are able to proceed, that we don't know what is coming, but we know there's a commercial banks, the Ed Current is providing for the commercials and so on. So don't worry, Chair, we'll always go back and forth. It's normal.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got a huge problem with this either-or thing. You know the rules of the game or you don't know the rules of the game. I think it's very difficult and it's very dangerous going this road, this either-or thing. I'm feeling very, very strong about that. We must know exactly what we are doing with this bill and not guessing what is going to happen in future. I reiterate it, sir. It is dangerous what we are doing now. We must know exactly what we do.
So, let's be clear about a few things here, right? One of the first things a committee does, before it even starts with any clause, it takes a decision. Is this a desirable bill? But if we said at that stage that it's not desirable, then the logical thing to do is for the minister to withdraw this bill. And then to wait for whatever legislation comes, then you are clear what you want to achieve. But the cabinet felt that in spite of all of those things, it's still desirable to table the bill before Parliament so that the Post Bank can get on with its life. And it put it before us. When we had the initial briefings, that after that clarity, etc., we took a decision as a committee that it is desirable to proceed with the matter. Once you take that decision, this is your bill, now you are working with it. And based on that decision we've taken, we are now trying to amend it, to give it, if you remember Johnny's thing, is what kind of a bird is this? Is this an ostrich? Is this a duck? Is it what? And chicken. Now we are giving it some form. But you see, your vision must be clear. Then you give it the proper form. So that's what we're trying to do. But at this stage, I'm afraid, I don't think we can withdraw the bill now, right? I mean, it's here, we have gone too far. So we must give it the kind of things we want. Now, all that this Section 4 does is that it creates legal flexibility that should another law come into operation at some point in the future, it allows for this bank to be registered under that system. It's only an enabling mechanism. That's all it is that Section 4 does here. Nothing complicated or confusing here. It can remain under the Banks Act and still exist. But it could remain under a new legislation when that legislation comes into effect. That's all the Section 4 is doing, all of those clauses. So we are not confused. Let's be clear about it. But I'm going to give finance there in the corner. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting your name now. That's right.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just to try to provide a bit of clarity in respect of a couple of the questions that have been raised. In respect of the Banks Act really is providing a regulatory framework for banking institutions generally. It doesn't prescribe particular types of banks per se. It sets out requirements of how banks must register, how they must report certain capital adequacy requirements, etc., that they must maintain in their operations, and how they're overseen by the registrar of banks. It's not prescribing per se that they must necessarily be strictly on a commercial basis, or that they may not necessarily take other certain objectives into consideration. It's setting out a regulatory framework for the bank. So even if this institution was registered in terms of the Banks Act, it wouldn't necessarily have to operate in exactly the same way as other commercial institutions operate. The Banks Act doesn't necessarily dictate that the banking institutions have to operate, you know, strictly in accordance with certain, you know, common commercial principles, for say, and operate as the typical commercial bank. The rationale for the development of the dedicated bank bill, which we are urgently trying to finalize, as has been indicated, we will be trying to get into Parliament early next year, is that to have a piece of legislation that is perhaps more appropriately, specifically tailored to the particular type of institution that may be trying to access, you know, the types of markets that previously have not been appropriately accessed by banking institutions. And the Post Bank would certainly be a prime example of a type of institution that would be trying to access those types of markets. And certain of the provisions in that regulatory framework, the requirements might be slightly different in a particular respect from what may be provided in the Banks Act to try to more appropriately cater for the rationale and the operations of that type of institution and the type of operations that they are likely to be carrying on. So it's trying to develop a piece of legislation that would, you know, particularly try to cater for a type of institution that might be slightly different from the typical commercial banking institution. So that is the rationale for the development of the dedicated bank bill. And so we, as has been indicated, the National Treasury isn't wanting to, delay the establishment of the Post Bank. But we do think that the current proposed provision that provides some of that legal flexibility would ultimately provide an opportunity to ensure ultimately that the bank, that the Post Bank will be regulated in terms of the legislation that is most appropriate for its particular operation. So I think that is why our view is beneficial at this stage to include that bit of flexibility to enable ultimately the bank to be regulated in the most appropriate manner for its operation.
All right, can we live with Flop 4? We don't know that. We don't know. All right. 5. Do you want to have that fresh coffee? Do you want to have a 5-minute coffee break?
Thank you. I would like to try.
sub 3 is inserted to ensure that the compliance with policies issued to the clause 25. Members shall recall that one of the meetings that we attended, I think took almost half a day, Honorable Member DeLange, he gave an overview of what one to see role of the minister on policy making powers. Reference that meeting, a meeting was held with Treasury to provide a meaning to that effect. As by the CPC decision, amendment has been made to clause 25 for the board composed of 10 executive members and managing director who is executive members instead of 15 members. In the last meeting, Chairperson, I think the committee felt that the board was too bloated and they recommend that we need to, in fact, they literally give a number of board members that will be appointed by the minister. Hence, amendment of clause 12 of the bill in front of members. The amendment reads that the board consists of not more than 9 instead of 15 executive members. And the managing director who is a member of the board should be part of the board member. So this was the intervention of the members in the previous meeting. I shall pause, Chairperson.
Any questions? These were the mandates we had given them. Agreed?
Thank you, Chair. Whereas you should also refer to Schedule 1 at this stage, and you'll see Schedule 1, we are proposing to take the whole schedule out. So Schedule 1, you'll remember, states that firstly there's a process. Before the actual transfer date can be announced by the minister, employees of the post bank need to make a choice. They need to elect either to go to the post bank or to remain employees of the post office and be seconded to the post bank. So that's process-wise, that's one step that must be taken. Secondly, the rest of Schedule 1 just protects the rights of employees, in our view. It said they must be transferred on no less favorable terms and conditions. Their pension must be protected, their leave must be protected, etc., etc. So in our view, those are fairly standard provisions to ensure that during this transfer from the post office to the post bank, at least the employees, the staff, are protected. Then, due to Kusatu's intervention, we said let's take out the schedule and simply refer to the Labor Relations Act. So the transfer is still subject to the Labor Relations Act. Because, and I think there are labor lawyers present that could take it further, but it contains provisions like Section 197 that deals with how do you go about when transferring a business from one to the other, how should you negotiate on issues of staff. So at the end of the day, still at least there is the protection of the Labor Relations Act that would ensure that I think the rights and obligations of employees are maintained. It's a much simpler way of doing it, but in our view, you could still retain Schedule 1 because it's a clear protection of rights. But on the other hand, as suggested, we can amend Clause 7 and simply refer to subject to compliance with the Labor Relations Act. because then even in that instance, staff will be protected during negotiations that will precede the transfer.
Is that clear? Right. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So I'm asking, is there any question? We are on 12. Okay, can we move on?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Clause 14, appointment of board members. Clause 14 is amended to provide for the nomination committee to obtain the registrar of banks approval if a person is a fit and proper person to hold the office as board member. This will ensure that various authorities approval from banking and other relevant non-banking regulators are compliant. Members shall recall that the initial bill used to give powers minister to seek approval from the registrar of banks. And the committee felt that because the minister cannot be authority to the regulator, let the nomination committee provide and seek power from the registrar of banks, and the role of the minister shall be to sign an appointment. The following paragraph D added to clause 14.4 as follows. In consultation with the registrar of banks, whether the candidate is, as far as can reasonably be ascertained, a fit and proper person to hold the office of member of the board of banking institutions. As a PCC recommendation, a provision is also inserted in 14.6a to empower the minister to designate two members of the post office board as members of post bank by virtue of office. The amendment reads that should be designated to non-executive members of the board from suitable persons nominated by the post office as contained in subsection 1B and appoint the other non-executive members of the board from suitable persons nominated as contained in subsection 4. I think this addresses the question that as a holding company, rather than the previous discussion that Chair discussed here, the post office has to appoint two members to sit as board members of the new company. I'll pause there.
Chief, can I add to that, just to go to the heart of what I think was the issue before, and that was the role of the registrar of banks in all of this, because it was said the banking legislation talks about board members being fit and proper persons, and the issue was raised by Treasury, and we were referred back to then bring in a role for either bring in the role for the registrar of banks or find an alternative mechanism to ensure that these board members are at the end of the day fit and proper persons. So I think that's what we've tried to do here. There are two processes running in parallel. If we talk about the 9 non-executive board members, 2 of them will be recommended by the SOPO board. But the SOPO board is acting in consultation with the registrar of banks. So at that level already, before SOPO can make that recommendation to the minister, they've already consulted with the registrar of banks, and therefore those 2 candidates they recommend will be fit and proper persons. At the same time, there's a selection committee or panel that after public invitation of nominations, they sit and they shortlist. Again, that selection committee must consult with the registrar of banks to ensure that the people they recommend to the minister are fit and proper persons. So by the time recommendations reach the minister from the post office and the selection committee respectively, those 2 bodies would already have consulted with the Red Shop banks, and therefore the recommendation in front of the minister would be only of people that are in fact fit and proper. So that was the main object which we tried to cater for, and we hope we have achieved.
Back when we were dealing with Clause 4, we got stuck on the dedicated banks thing, and I forgot to query Subsection 3. Notwithstanding Section 43 of the Banks Act, blah, 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 the post office is not required to register as a controlling company of the company, and the appointment of the board of the post office is not subject to the approval of the registrar of banks. And I was going to ask why. So it's exempted in Clause 4, and then various... sort of circuitous systems are put in place to bring in the registrar of banks in Clause 14. Why not? I mean, it seems like a roundabout way just to involve the registrar of banks. Why the exemption in the first place?
Thanks, Jay. I think at the heart of this bill, and Janine would probably be able to answer better, is that we have now built in a role for the registrar of banks. There's no doubt about that. That particular section that the Honourable Member is referring to is, as a result of our deliberations with Treasury, we came across this clause, or Section 43 in the Banks Act, and that simply says that if you register as a bank, but you are owned, there's a holding company that owns the majority of your shares, which would be in this case the post office owning the majority of the shares in the post bank, then that holding company, in other words, the post office in this case, will also have to register with the registrar of banks. And furthermore, the registrar of banks will also have to approve its board members to be fit and proper people. So that creates a problem. That's not the intention I think we have, and therefore we decided let's try to exclude the applicability of that provision in this instance.
Yes. I think that was long-winded. Sorry to interrupt, but why is that so undesirable, given Eric's mention earlier of the fact that we're talking about the minister running the bank, but the SAPA having a role? If SAPA really take, I mean, maybe we're moving around in circles here, and I apologize if we are, but if SAPA is supposed to have a role, and if it is a proper subsidiary of the post office, then why not subject SAPA to the same rigors that the post bank would be subjected to if it's involved in the running of the bank?
No, Chair. I pick it up what the Honourable Member is raising. But I just got comfort that currently we've got board members of post office appointed in the mid of their term. So if we want to subject them, it means it might have an impact. I think it's only for the current post office board, which are in office now, because they're in office already, they've been appointed. But I'm not sure what does it mean in future post office board appointment. But for now, I understood in that context that they are in office. You can't subject them now and try to say they are disqualified and so on and so on.
Can you clarify that?
Thank you. I think it actually is a little bit more than just the appointment of board members. As a controlling company of a bank, there are quite a lot of regulatory compliance imperatives that come in. And I think it's important to note that it actually is quite costly to comply in terms of the Banks Act. And I'm not too sure if the intention of this legislation is to then make the post office an entity that has to report under the Banks Act, because that is what would be the case.
Are very important. I think the objective was to ensure that the Post Bank itself will be, which is operating as a banking institution, will be appropriately regulated as a banking type of institution subject to the appropriate oversight of the registrar of banks. And when it was considered that with the post office with the post bank being a subsidiary of the post office, and most of the rest of the post office's operations are not banking operations, and it isn't really necessary or appropriate for all of those type of operations which are to be subject to the same type of oversight as the post bank is by the registrar of banks. And because of the implications which have been indicated for the operations of the post office, if it was required to register as a controlling company in terms of the Bank Act of the post bank, then it was felt that perhaps it would be appropriate to provide for an exemption that the post office wouldn't necessarily have to register as a controlling company in terms of the Bank Act. But it would be required that the post office would be fully basically regulated in terms of banking legislation, and all members of the board of the post bank, not the post office, but the post bank, including those members of the post office board who would become members of the post bank, would be subject to the fit and proper scrutiny of the registrar of banks. So essentially all of the members of the board who are going to be responsible for the operations of the post bank would be subject to the full fit and proper scrutiny of the board. And so we thought that that was an appropriate way to try to balance, the practical operations of the post office while ensuring effective regulatory oversight by the registrar over the operations of the post bank, which is the appropriate focus of concern for the registrar.
Okay, let me just understand the process for myself. The board is made up of 10 members. One is the managing director, two come from the post office board, seven from public nominations. The minister invites the public and the board to nominate persons. He sets up a nominations committee, and the committee then, I suppose, does the fit and proper and all of that, and then recommends to him a set of names, seven from the public, two from the post office, to be appointed. No?
Except, Chair, that the post office recommends the two directly to the minister.
Yeah.
And the selection committee or nomination committee recommends the seven.
The seven.
Yeah.
Okay, let me just get this right. 1 minute.
And both respectively have consulted with the Registrar of Banks prior to recommending to the minister.
Yes.
You see, 14b says, am I reading this correctly? Invite the post office, acting in consultation with the Register of Banks, to submit the names of non-executive members of the board of the post office that are, as far as can reasonably be a fit and proper person to hold office for the banking. It doesn't say two. They could give five names.
Chair, please read that with subsection 6a, Roman 1, where... It's
or designate two members.
Yeah.
Okay. So then the minister basically determines seven names. And then publicizes those names in the government, appoints them to the government gazette, nine of them.
Yes.
Two from the post office and seven from the public. Have I got the steps right? Okay. I am clearing my mind. Patricia?
Jefferson, I just want to understand again clause 6A. That the minister must, within 30 days, after consensus has been reached with the Minister of Finance and the Post Office regarding the appointment of members, then appoint. And I'm reading this now, and what if there's no consensus? Can't we rather say, in consultation with the minister must, within 30 days, appoint after or in consultation with, because consensus is just too broad for legal. Are they going to vote to reach consensus between the three of them? Will the minister's word be final? I can't remember that. I know I've made some notes when we were dealing with it some time ago on the 20th of April. The minister must, within 30 days after obtaining the permission of the registrar, and after consensus has been reached with the Minister of Finance and the Post Office regarding the appointment of members, appoint members. We almost had a discussion like that also at one stage. I can't. I don't
know. From the same point, Megan? Same point or different point?
Yes, I just want to be certain. Is there a minimum amount that this nomination committee must give to the minister, or the exact amount that the minister must choose out? Must it be 20 or more than double the figure that is going to be appointed? I just want to, for clarity, sir.
Julie?
Chairperson,
I actually wanted to comment on what Honourable Dalila said. I think I actually quite like the consensus-seeking paragraph. Consultation is usually could be interpreted in different ways. It could mean that I speak to you and then I've consulted you and thereafter I follow my mind. Whereas if they're looking for consensus, it is really to reflect all the different considerations and criteria. So I actually quite like the idea of consensus.
Chairperson, maybe I should have explained. After consultation means that the minister must just consult, he doesn't need to seek the agreement of them. If it says in consultation with, it means that he must get the agreement of the others. So consensus is in between after consultation and in consultation. I'm saying let's make it clear whether it is in consultation or after consultation.
All right.
Well, Chair, from my reading, after consensus has been reached means after obtaining approval. It means the same as in consultation. So the minister simply cannot proceed with an appointment unless the Minister of Finance and the Post Office also agrees. That's the bottom line. We can reword it to read in consultation if the committee so chooses, but I think it requires approval at the moment.
Is that clear in legal language? Yeah, I see a nodding. All right. There's this question of should there be a minimum list of nominees, or should it be more than the seven from the nominating committee?
Thank you, Chair. I think it means the exact number must be recommended by the nomination committee. It's different to some other processes where 1.5 times, for example, are recommended and the minister could choose. In this instance, the nomination committee must recommend the exact number that's required.
Is that what we want?
Well, especially...
because, I mean, the minister is appointing all these people, but he doesn't interview these people, he doesn't process the application. He gets a list of 7 names and 2 from the post office, and all he does is just agree. What is his discretion or his, as an executive or the indirect shareholder? What is his role in this? Yeah. Hey, we've got enough problems on our hands. Eric?
You know, Chair, I hear the concerns, but I think we're asking the wrong people. We must battle with that ourselves. If we want to be more, so that we give that provision. I understand the stretch jacketing, which we give the president on the SABC board, that we give 12, the president is appointed. There's no leeway, whether this or that and so on, that's a straitjacketing sort of approach and so on. But I think it's a matter we must battle with on the ourselves in terms of whether we want that and so on. But we love some flexibility to be there, but maybe it's a matter we can come back on it and finalize it.
Let me test something. You see, I think it's important. If you look at 5, my sense is 5, subclause 5 says, if the nominations committee comes with under 7 names, right, that's what it means, then the minister, together with the Minister of Finance and the post office, can identify, say additional numbers and fill the gap. Okay? But should we not, can we not, can I test the proposal? Can we not say that the nominations committee should give a maximum of 10 names? So that there's a discretion for the minister. I mean, there might be certain factors, gender, race, any number of things, I don't know. But at least, whoever the minister is, got some selection process. Mr. Buzilevi.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Before we get to that, I think you're asking on what is the role of the minister. That the minister appoints the nominating committee, so he's already had, he would have had his share kind of around appointing the nominating committee, so it doesn't necessarily need to get directly involved. But we still have not addressed what Honourable Member Dillon raised, when ministers don't agree, it's a possibility. So we need to put a proviso, what happens, if there's no agreement between the three parties that are staying in consultation. Maybe we can discuss it later. If there's no agreement, what do we do? Does the business stop? It will be running as a bank. Or it can get dysfunctional for a few months.
No, we agreed that it means the same thing.
No, it doesn't mean the same thing.
But that's what the lawyer is saying.
You must first consult to have consensus. No.
No, Chairperson,
can I just also say we use the word. We must really clean up the act. Some places we say the minister may with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. Mm-hmm. And then we say the minister must within 30 days after consensus has been reached with the Minister of Finance. And right here in front we say in consultation with the Registrar of Banks. Let's just keep the language consistent, then it's fine.
No, the legal people said we can put in consultation if that's what you want. But you see, my concern is this, and that's why I'm raising this matter, because if the nominations committee can only give you 7 names or under 7 names, let's say they give you 7 names, the actual exercise of consultation with the Minister of Finance and the Post Office is a non-exercise, because you must appoint those people. What are you consulting about? It's a nonsensical step. It's only if you give them a discretion, then they can start saying, look, let's rather go for this person instead of this person. But if you're giving them 7 names full, there's nothing to consult about. They must appoint. Niji?
Chairperson, if you look there at 4, subsection A, it's making a recommendation that the minister must consider. There's a lot of proven skills, financial management projects, etc., etc. If you count that together, it's almost 7, and you want all this specific skills and knowledge on that board. And I think that will sort of make the playing field level, and there must be that, all those skills must be involved in that nomination process. But I think it will be covered to make sure that we have the proven skills on that board. Thank you.
You raised the issue that what are you consulting if the number has been determined? The president and so on. That's why I was raising the issue that I think the point which has been raised of the actual number is a critical issue, that you might need some flexibility in terms of opening up in terms of the number of people which need to be submitted. But I was saying, Chair, at this point, ourselves are not ready to take that decision as an ANC here. we still need to further consult on that. We'll come back on that matter. But we say we listen and hear and acknowledge that possibility so that we have some sensibility. So we're not going to fully engage now ourselves because we have not engaged and come up with a clear way forward on the matter.
Okay, so we're looking at the possibility of increasing the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some room for discretion. But we will come back what the numbers will be, etc., after we have a discussion.
Jay, if you're going to do that, then I propose that you say 1.5 times, because this same process will also be used to fill vacancies. So in the case of a vacancy, it might be 1 or 2 or 3. So you don't want specific numbers in terms of the number that must be recommended, rather than say 1.5 times the required number.
Okay, so that's something we will keep in mind. 1.5 times would mean what? 7 plus? No, I know that, but it will be how many? Just give me a list of how many? 9, 10, 15. No, 9 plus 5. So it's 14 names. 2 from the post office, and the post office must give 3. And the nomination committee must give 11. All right? We'll keep that in mind. Can we move off this one then? 15? Nothing? Was it 15?
Thanks, Chair. Clause 15, members is hereby amended to allow removal of member if the Register of Banks informs the minister that a member is no longer a fit and proper person as required. Clause 16 also amend to delete all under 16E(3), since it is not possible to attend all board meetings. Further than that, subclause 2 that makes non-compliance with fiduciary duties and offence has also been deleted as per the recommendation of the PCC. I will pause, Chair.
15. 15. Speaking.
Can we go to clause 16D? I just want to get it done. A member is absent from 3 consecutive board meetings without timely work acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I'm just making a question. What if you become sick and you are unable even, to forward your apology or your treatment? How are you going to deal with the treatment? Because there are instances of circumstances that is really causing you not even to get that approval in the same time. Or you are sick and suffering and overseas. How do you handle that situation?
Chair, the object of the clause was firstly because in 16(1)(e)(3) we took out the previous obligation that said the members must regularly attend all board meetings. Somebody then raised at the time, you can't say all board meetings because there would be instances where a board member simply cannot be there. So then we took out the all, so they must attend board meetings, but then we inserted this ground of removal if you then are absent for 3 consecutive board meetings, you may be removed. But importantly, they without prior leave of the chairperson. So I'm not a board member, so I'm not sure how it works in practice, but I must assume that a board member would just call up the chairperson or in some way communicate with the chair and seek leave to be absent due to illness or whatever other reason. And even if there's one instance due to somebody being overseas and not being in reach, that might be an exception, but it's very unlikely that that would happen 3 consecutive times. I don't think it's too harsh, the current wording, Chair.
In any event, this is a standard provision. I mean, we've seen this in other legislation also. Okay. Are we okay with 15? Can we move? 16? There's nothing? Except the one small amendment. We're deleting all there, eh? Okay. 17? No. Are you deleting that subclause 2, on page 15?
Yes.
Chair, you'll remember that you recommended that because the question was, is it fair to make noncompliance with a fiduciary duty an offence? And we thought about it, and we think perhaps it's better to remove it, especially because non-compliance with a fiduciary duty would mean a board member is not complying with this act, and as such, that's a ground of removal in any event. So it's a policy decision whether you want to make it a criminal offence as well, but I don't think it's generally regarded as such seriousness, such serious a breach that it must be regarded as a criminal offence.
Mr. Kulwani and Julie?
Just a question about fiduciary duties. Is it not covered in the PFMA in anything? So that it is not necessarily important to mention it in this act because it is already covered in the PFMA.
Well, Chair, the fiduciary duties emanate from a number of documents and legislation that places obligations on board members that together would constitute fiduciary duties. And at least in case of this act, if you breach this act, it's a ground for removal. So there's that added ground at least.
Jefferson, the original clause said any member who fails to comply with any fiduciary duties referred to in subsection 1 or any former member who failed to comply with such fiduciary duties while being a member commits an offence and is liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment not exceeding 5 years or both or fine and such imprisonment. That is where we started debating from in April. Now, I think that you know, any person, whether you are a trustee or whether you are a board member, your fiduciary duties is quite serious. I mean, it is the reason why you are there. And sometimes you find that in some trusts they even have, as part of your fiduciary duties, they also hold you criminal and individually liable. Because sometimes, I've served to many trusts in the past, and some of them, when I started to see that, you know, but things doesn't seem to worry, I move. Because I don't want to put myself at risk as a trustee in terms of fiduciary duty to take personal liability. My understanding was that we were not going to be prescriptive in terms of a conviction and a fine or imprisonment, that we delete that, but that we keep the first part which says it's an offense. That is my understanding. I don't know if I remember correctly. But certainly not to delete the whole clause. And especially when you're dealing with money and banking. It's fiduciary duty. Yeah. Fiduciary duties is very important.
Chair, initially we had the same view, but after considering your view, which I thought was to seriously consider rather removing the clause, we thought it's worth the while because most of these fiduciary duties are in any event covered by other legislation. If we talk PFMA, if we talk about the relevant banking legislation, that would certainly have strict requirements and serious criminal offences linked to it, I'm convinced. And lastly, the fact that most of these powers are similar to the powers in the Companies Act, which in turn would have appropriate corresponding criminal provisions linked to it. So I think we're fairly covered as is without this clause.
Can we live with the deletion? On the understanding that it's covered in other legislation?
Any harm in keeping it? No, but keeping it up without the, and it's liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment. You know, maybe that last part. And just keep it up to commit an offence.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to refresh the Honourable Member's memory that the Post Office had actually requested that this clause should also be deleted. And the reason for that is because we would like to put forward the fact that we wouldn't want this bank or this company to have more onerous provisions for its board members than any other average company out there. And that for us was the reasoning behind the request that this particular provision should be taken out. Because it would be important that the bank is then not prejudiced in the caliber of people that it gets as a result of people viewing being in this company being more onerous than it already is to be a director in other companies. And the new Companies Act as well is actually putting forward more stringent provisions as far as the responsibilities of directors. And we would be comfortable to be in keeping with that. And these particular directors are also going to be subject to the Companies Act as it is coming in.
Any comments there?
See, there's certainly no harm in repeating it, because remember, we are creating an entity here that's still not defined, that will not be automatically be subject to Company Act legislation, to this one legislation. So I think if it's not going to cause any harm, you know, and it will not cause any harm, it's merely a reminder to the board members that if you fail to comply, there will be consequences.
Chair, after discussing with my colleagues, we're comfortable with retaining it. We have initially suggested it. We're just considering your proposal, but we're comfortable to still retain it. And I think the State Law Advisor can just advise why it's appropriate to link a certain penalty to an offence, because I'm advised there's a reason for that.
Thank you, Chair. And in relation to the Honourable Brother's suggestion, that it can be maybe we state only the create an offence without the penalties, that will be a problem, because we'll have to specify then the penalties for this particular offence, because it will be a statutory offence.
You know, I mean, if for instance, look at, if you take the National Prosecuting Authority Act, it says anybody interfering with the independence of the National Prosecuting Authority is liable for a criminal act. And then it leaves it like that. Because and if this is a criminal offense, then we should say so, it's a criminal offense or whatever. So that's why I say if we just leave it at offense, and then, you know, subject to Administration of Justice Act. There's such a lot of these things. And, you know, I'm not that clever a lawyer to find synergy there and bring them together.
I'm also being advised by our parliamentary law advisor. You see, if you look at the whole clause 16, it lists a range of fiduciary duties, right? Now, some talk about no conflict of interest and those kinds of other things, like attending meetings.
And you don't want to criminalize some of those things if you fail to attend board meetings. It can be a criminal offense, 5 year sentence. Perhaps it was with that in mind that the decision or the suggestion was that we delete that, and understanding that there are other applicable legislation. Because then we'll have to specify which specific misconduct is worthy of a penalty of you know, a criminal penalty. Now, if you look at here, E1, a board member must take reasonable steps to inform himself or herself about the company, its business and activities and the circumstances in which it operates. Now, if I don't do that, can I be charged criminally? So I think we just then need to be a bit careful what we are insisting on.
Are you saying that once we put in an offense, we must specify what type of offense? Is this what you are saying? Okay, so you can't put in the word offense.
I think the chair is saying we should specify which actions in 16.1 constitute an offence specifically, so that it's not an offence necessarily not to attend board meetings, but it may be an offence not to disclose a financial interest.
Well, can I suggest that the legal people come with a proposal for us, understanding what is the most serious thing. Misdemeanors or misconduct could be there. That will lead that to some kind of criminal
offense. So we sort this out in some kind of logical way, and then you specify which are the specific actions that you can be engaged. I think the law advisors can give us good advice here, but I think if somebody does something wrong, it is in the hands of the prosecutor to decide if they are going to file a case against a certain person. So I don't think it's necessary for us to write it in this bill, because if you cause an offence, then the prosecutor will decide if they are going to file a case against. I don't know if I'm right, law advisor.
Just a quick response to that. In general, you get common law offences that is not specified in any specific statute. Theft, for example, is a common law offence. So a board member can still be prosecuted for some form of theft without it being written into any law that he shouldn't be stealing. But what we're doing here is we're creating a statutory offence, which is a specific offence relating to a specific action. So you have the right to do that, provided you regard a specific action or contravention to be of such serious nature that it must be treated as an offence. Then you can say non-disclosure of a financial interest constitutes an offence. Then the prosecutor would use this particular clause in addition to the common law offence, if any, to do the prosecutorial work. And the magistrate in turn would use the relevant penalty part to determine what kind of penalty can be imposed if found guilty.
Okay, come to the proposal.
Yeah. Well, to consider next week. See you.
Chairperson, I was going to humbly request that with the advice of the PCC the last time that this clause be deleted for that, and then we put it through there, because it is not only the common law offences, it is the Companies Act, it is the PFMA, it is all that the board members will be subjected to. But secondly, I think we need to look at the practicality of us trying to create this company and getting board members to come through and say, on top of that, if I take all that is listed under 16, I then would be creating an offence that would have to be determined by somebody, and it may not just be practical for us to do that. So, from the post office point of view, as we rework, we would really humbly request that clause in totality be deleted. And we know that we will have other legislations that will apply that will make it possible for any office that might be created undertaking duties of the board.
Chair, I think those are two different things. Either we have a mandate to refine it, or not to include it at all. If the mandate remains that we have to look, come up with a proposal and determine which of the actions or breaches are of a serious nature, I think we can do that, and perhaps in that instance we should have regard to the other laws, so that in the Companies Act, which apparently mirrors paragraph subclause A, B, and C, there's a specific offence there created and a penalty. We try to do something similar here, not to create these types of contradictions. So we'll do that type of work if you so propose, as Chair.
Chair, I'm sure, Chair, let's move with what we have said, but we'll consider what Post Office is saying.
Come with a proposal. I mean, we've got this already on the table. Let's see if we can't come with something, and then we can take a decision next week. 17, nothing. 18, nothing. 19, nothing. Is there something on 19?
No.
Nothing. 20. No, there's something in 20.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Clause 20, sub-clause 2 is amended to remove the requirement that the Managing Director and the Minister of Finance should be consulted before the Board can determine condition of service of staff. The new revised provision reads that the Board must determine the conditions of service remuneration and service benefits of the company. This was after they recommended the PCC that the process is too long, we need to short-circuit it, and then with the support of the Post Office then in that meeting, I remember, hence the new provisions as inserted and amended. Thank you, Chair.
Just explain, Chair, but if you say that we must remove the 22 is amended to remove the requirement that the Managing Director and the Minister of Finance should be consulted before the Board can determine conditions of service of staff.
Yes.
Yeah, but I can't remember that when. Again, you know, you will help me on this. Because, you know, right now, government is reviewing all the boards. And, you know, if you look at what happened at Eskom, for instance, you cannot allow a board just to decide on bonuses and extra this and extra that. And I think it's for that reason that we actually suggested that the process is underway. There's been a committee appointed by the president. And I think we need to be mindful of what the intentions of government government is with bringing about that kind of amendment. Boards have been letting us down big time in terms of conditions of employment.
After consultation, the
Minister of the Concerns of the Minister, is that highlighted here, is it going to come in or is it going to be taken out? No. I don't agree.
I'm looking at my
notes,
that's exactly what you said.
No, definitely not me, Chairperson. I can tell you now, I've made the example the last time about what government's intention is. We have made the example about how that is being abused by boards, and it's not their money, it's public money. And again, you know, the same must be applicable here. I can't remember I've agreed to it. Unless it was outside of the meeting, but for now I don't agree.
Okay. No, that's fine. I mean, if you want to review this, fine. What are people saying? Advocate, want to say something?
No, Chair. At the time, I remember asking Treasury, well, do you think it's important that you be consulted? And they said, no, we don't have a role to play here. So perhaps they can just highlight that. But on the other, initially, I was opposed to this amendment because I thought it's better having this extra control. But at the same time, if you want to entrust fiduciary duties to board members, perhaps you should be allowed, they should be allowed to then exercise those duties in good faith and the trust you place in them.
No, sir. My problem is that it's too broad and general. I don't assume a situation where you need the minister or whoever the board to deal with a cleaner or a person at the tail and so on. I'm not sure whether what we're trying to mean is everyone, but if it's the only upper, higher management at the upper level, I understand. But generally, that would have everyone being subjected to a little bit clumsy.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to highlight that the clause was meant to be looking at staff in general. For the upper level, which is the managing director, those are covered in clause number 19, where in fact not only the performance contract, the remuneration package will be determined by the board in concurrence with the Minister of Finance in terms of the responsibilities that you deal with. Here we are talking about the general conditions of staff and other issues that you need to deal with.
Thank you for reminding.
Thank you very much. Can't lie? What are you saying? Yeah, it can't lie. Right, 21? We did say not less than 5 months. Yeah? Sorry?
Okay, thanks, Honorable.
No, hold on, Mr. Kulwani.
I'm not sure if I understood the honourable member properly, saying in being such persons as the board may with concurrence of the managing director of the company appoint. Just to explain what that would take care of, it would take care of looking at filling the full stack of the post bank in terms of the issues, the people and the relevant personnel that would be required to go through with running the bank. The managing director, in consultation with the board, would have what we'd have as a normal delegation of authority in terms of where they would appoint and where they would have the authority to go through that. So that would then deal with that issue. It deals only with that with that issue. I'm not sure if I understood you very well, Honourable Member.
No, that is the board subjected to the concurrence of the managing director, or the managing director should be subjected to the board. I'm just saying with the sequence of the sentence, whether it's correct, that the board with the concurrence or vice versa. I'm just trying to understand it.
I think maybe it's just in doing it, but it is always the managing director in concurrence with the board. We don't deal with it, yes.
Have we changed that then? Because the whole board can agree on something and then anytime it says no, and you can't have. So he's in the decision-maker. It's the other way around. Can that be corrected then for us? Adhikari, you raised the matter, I'm not clear.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to check with you. That was from past, and I'm not sure if they were. It doesn't appear from the past.
The question is, was NetLec consulted on some of these issues? Mr. Botelezi?
I think that the issue was raised by Commercial Workers Union and COSATU. We then had a process where we were engaging them on the side. you know, post office LR people, the CEO and their president on the side, so that we prepare to go to NEDLAC with one store, not the multiple store on the issue of these issues. So we've met, I think, just once. The other meeting was postponed, but we're still meeting to try and prepare in a package that is either going to be presented by either of us themselves or ourselves. To address that, like,
Is there a requirement that we consult that?
Well,
now we've already, passed the stage.
But that has to be basically waived back after consultation subsequently.
Okay, so can this matter be followed through with Candidate? Mm. We don't want also the candidates to have to do with the conditions and formally done.
We're trying to prepare a joint submission that is going to be led either by COSATU or Commercial Workers Union or SAPO or ourselves in presenting, but a joint presentation that says how far we've gone on the bill, what are the issues, and how far it's been resolved, so what mandate did we get from the PC, is how far we've gone on the issues, just to keep them abreast and to get their consensus on some of the issues that they are raising. It's after we decided to withdraw that those LR issues that you had raised earlier on. But we decided, if it is fine, then prepare for a submission to COSATU to decide what we do. So then, until next level,
okay, well, let me order. You will give us a report then on that.
Can
you
I was just asking for clarity, Chair, so that we are very clear what happens after here. Are we being asked to consult with NEDLAC or to check if it is a requirement for consulting with NEDLAC on the issues if discussions with CWU are continuing? I just wanted to get that clarity in our mind. The latter, to check the requirement for the NEDLAC. Okay, thank you.
Okay. 21. Did you have a... Sorry, Kapilwani?
No, Chair. It's a simple math. I just need the clarity, Chair. It's saying 21.1. This company, I assume it's the Post Bank, will submit a report to the minister about the activities, blah, 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 and so on. Now, this company is a subsidiary for Post Office. It submit a report direct to the minister. I just want to understand what is the internet operation, how it's going to happen. Because the clarity, Chair, it might be a bigger issue. But the clarity is that I've not seen subsidiary companies reporting to portfolio committees. Only the holding company, if it is come, report on behalf of everything. I just want to understand here, what does that mean? It means whether Post Bank will submit to the minister, Post Office, in between, what exactly does it mean? I just want to understand that. So what's a subsidiary company, something else?
Yeah. Are you expecting us to call in the Post Bank then? As an additional entity to come and report? Are you just, this is a courtesy.
Yeah, I think we do take advice from the honorable member that we'd have to relook into that.
Okay, so you'll come back on this one.
But Chair, if we read the advice the state law advisor gave at the time, it says the post office is a major public entity listed in Schedule 2 of the PFMA, must comply with all the requirements of that act relating to public entities. In terms of the same schedule, any subsidiary entity under the ownership control of the post office, inverted commas, is also a public entity. Thus, similarly to the post office, the post bank will have to comply with the PFMA. So the same reporting requirements that apply to the post office also applies to the post bank. So equally, that report must be submitted to Parliament through the executive.
Where
I think the provision is appropriate.
Where are you reading this?
I'm reading actually from the letter that was drafted to you, Chair, that spoke to the other issue about the executive role. And from there, it talks to the issue of major public entity and the post bank also being a public entity in turn, and therefore having to comply with the PFMA, including those reporting requirements.
But I think I understand that, okay? It's useful clearly. But does it mean that this committee then calls in the board of the post bank to come and report to it? It can, if it wishes to, independently of the board, of the post office. No, then the minister has to table it in parliament. It's there. That's the standard clause, that it has to table it then in parliament. And then parliament can choose whether it wants to call them in or not. But that might actually be a good idea. So that if people mess up like they messed up the land bank, at least somebody can hold them accountable. Can we leave this as is? The Kulwani? Come back. Covered in the articles of association?
Chair, I think we have the benefit of National Treasury being here and the PFMA experts being here and how subsidiaries are dealt with. It's nobody better positioned to answer it than them, Chair.
Okay, CEO and then Omega.
I'm not sure whether I should let National Treasury to just report what happened to a schedule to under PFMA. In fact, in the regulations, it's very clear that you do submit the corporate plans, you do submit the reports as per PFMA for all your state-owned enterprises that you serve, but it is still at the group level. And you are supposed to separate the different subsidiaries in terms of their performance in your submission of the report. So that tabling here, as I was asking, that we'd need to take it under advisement, is that as a controlling company, we would need to submit for the post office, inclusive of the subsidiary, a separate one for the subsidiary in terms of the issues that you need to go through and do. But I think National Treasury might advise better on this issue.
Omega?
Thank you, Chairperson. It is standard practice, if I may state it here, that both holding companies and their subsidiary submit their corporate strategic plan and business plan to the Minister of Finance as is required in terms of the PFMA. The PFMA further also says that holding companies or companies as listed in different schedules must submit such reports to Parliament. I think we had already said that this is repeating the provision of the PFMA, but the DOC have advised that they want to put it in here for emphasis. So, strictly speaking, yes, it is the expectation that the Post Bank will submit its annual report to this committee ultimately and may be called to account for the management and handling of such funds as they are at their disposal.
Okay, can we keep this in? Mario? 22, nothing? 23, nothing? 24? 1 o'clock. Yeah? 25.
Perhaps, Chair, I will humbly draw you to step back on the heading of Chapter 4 as you move from clause 22 to clause 21 in accordance with the arrangement of the sections in the beginning. So there are that alignment of heading just to align clause 22 to 21. In arrangement of the sections in the beginning.
Okay.
Clause 25, Honorable Chair, this clause came into being after the meeting that the committee felt that it's quite imperative for the minister to have policy making powers in the bill, and I guess members shall recall that on the day Honorable Member De Lange was quite vocal on this matter. And the agreement was the fact that we need to amend clause 25 to include regulation and policy. And the decision was agreed with the committee in the last meeting. Clause 25.1 is amended to ensure that the register of banks, in concert before the regulations are made, read that the minister may, on the recommendation of the board, and with concurrent of the Minister of Finance and after with the Register of Banks, make regulations regarding the following issues. And drawing back down to 25.2, the Minister may make policies on matters of national policy applicable to the company concerned with the object of this Act after consult with the Minister of Finance. This decision was made by the committee and agreed between DOC and Treasury working team in the previous meeting. I pause, Chairperson.
Petition.
Chairperson, I just see clarity on 25.1. The minister may, on the recommendation of the board, which means the minister's got a choice there, and with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, comma, and after consultation with the Register of the Banks, make regulations. I think we need to simplify that. It is trying to bring a lot of steps in one or two sentences, but also in terms of making regulations, that is the duty of the minister, the executive too. So are we saying that when the minister makes the regulations or draft the regulations, he must consult with the registrar, and then after consultation, he can go ahead and draft whatever regulation he wants to? I just think that we need redrafting here on 25.1 to make it clear. But you think if they go to court and then there's at least an open, wide open for interpretation, and we should always try and write the law that it's clear and clearly anybody can interpret it. So that's my request.
Chief, I have to simplify. Can't we say the minister may, after consultation with the Register of Banks, make regulations regarding A and B? Because let's cut out Minister of Finance, because in effect, the important stakeholder here is the Register of Banks, and as long as we retain consultation with the Register of Banks, the minister should be able to continue making the regulations. Because the other prohibition here is, somebody may say, well, the minister can only make a recommendation upon receiving a recommendation of the board, not on an initiative. So perhaps to simplify, if I can repeat, the minister may, after consultation with the Register of Banks, make regulations regarding.
But, Chairperson, is it correct that the minister must consult the board to make a regulation?
No, he's saying the Register of Banks, not the board.
No, but what I'm saying is, here's a piece of legislation, it goes to Parliament, it then goes to the Minister to draft the regulation. Now, according to this, the Minister must then, before he drafts the regulations, he must get recommendations from the board. It interferes with the lawmaking process. That's my point.
Okay, Mr. Bertolesi.
Thank you, sir. I think I fully concur with the honourable member, because I think here we cluster two things. The minister's role as a policymaker in the ICT sector, and the minister's role as a shareholder in the business. They're two separate issues. What she's raising is very fundamental, because here what was raised on the regulation policy is around the postal sector, the space, because this post bank will operate in the postal sector, although it has a banking implication. But the minister, as the minister of the sector, he has the sectoral determination that he has to make. So what she's raising is very fundamental to separate the two. But here in this clause, we cluster the two. That's why it looks very clumsy. And it's been subject to multiple interpretations when it comes to court. So is the minister interfering now, or is he pronouncing as a shareholder, or is he pronouncing as a leader of the sector? Or,
no, Chair, maybe the reworking will be fine, but I don't see what is the problem of the board recommendation, recommending something to the minister, and the minister decide to regulate or not. And of course, are the people who are operational on the field and so on, they might be able to raise certain, they are expect they might be able to raise certain things to the attention of the minister, but the clause does not force the minister to take it and do it, still can have an overall policy. And so I don't see any contradiction except that the clause currently got a lot of things clubbed together. Maybe if they can try to separate it. We appoint this board, once they got expertise, they can be able to advise some other time, which will allow them to do so. But the regulation and the policy issue rests with the minister. You can recommend whatever, but it rests with the minister.
Julie?
Yeah, I think we perhaps just missing each other. How I understand it, how it was proposed that we rework it, is just to say that the minister may, after consultation with the Register of Banks, which is the core important clause, make regulations. That will include on recommendation from the board. But the concern is, if it is read as it was originally, it means it's only at the instance when the board recommends that the minister may make regulations. And that would limit his ability to make regulations. So what we're saying now is delete that clumsy sort of composition and just refer to the minister may, after consultation with the Register of Banks, make regulations regarding it.
Again, back to process. We draft the act passed by Parliament, it goes to the Minister to draft the regulation. It's only thereafter that the board will be appointed, because the regulations will spell out and take in consideration what is in the Act as to how the board must be appointed. I've not heard in any piece of legislation where which is the minister's prerogative to draw up that regulations. In fact, at one stage, we had Parliament complained. We said we wanted to be part of that process of drafting regulations. And we still are not, because that's the prerogative of the minister. So the board comes afterwards. After the Act and the regulations is done, then you get to the implementation, which will then establish the board.
Okay, so are we agreeing here that the minister may, after consultation with the Register of Banks, make regulations regarding? Are we clear? Just propose, Janine?
Could we propose, after consultation with the Minister of Finance and the Register of Banks?
After consultation with the Minister of Finance and the Register of Banks? Can we live with that? There is a solace. The minister may, after consultation with the Minister of Finance and the Register of Banks, make regulations regarding. Well, Mr. Kolwan is asking why.
The rest of them belong under that minister. Why the minister end? That's asking, because if the minister consults that minister, obviously that minister before can respond to go to this institution and get whatever information and come to the minister. So why the minister at that level? And that's what I'm asking. Why was the rationale? Because if you consult the minister of the minister part of the institution.
Lawyers?
We could agree with that comment because in theory, the Register of Banks is an official. Now you're subjecting the executive to consultation with an official, which isn't appropriate. It's more appropriate to just have the consultation with the Minister of Finance then, if we agree, if we can convince National Treasury of that.
So, the Minister may, after consultation with the Minister of Finance, make regulations regarding. Okay? Are we happy with 25.2 because that is what we insisted on? 25.2? After the consultation with the Minister of Finance. Omega?
There is a minor issue there, Chairperson. We in the Treasury we would have wished that the two ministers reach some kind of consensus in making a policy determination relating to the cost bank. Given that we're dealing with a bank that was struggling between the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Communication. So rather than mere consultation as is proposed here, through the after consultation, we will propose that it is in consultation with the Minister of Finance.
In consultation, that is the proposal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I have a slight challenge, but it's fine. I'll leave it in. And that challenge will go back to what Honourable Member did raise. What if they don't agree? Or one minister has gone out, like our minister has gone for 2 or 3 months, or a determination, you know, a decision has to be made, policy related, and as a quicker. Or there's no agreement. Does it mean the business will stop? Or what does it mean? Do we have to go to court or go elsewhere when they don't agree? Those kind of provisions we need to put in place.
Stella?
You know what the problem here is that you don't make policy after an act. You have the policy and then an act is derived from that policy put into law. Now here it say the minister make policy on matters of national policy applicable to the company consistent with the objects of this act in consultation with the Minister of Finance. The minister, we've got a green paper here. Previous minister was involved in the policy making, and the policy and the green. I mean, and the white paper was approved by cabinet. Where we are now is to bring legislation that can speak to the white paper. So, what is this policy that the minister still wants? What extra policy does he want? It doesn't make sense at all.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think I will start by saying we prefer a scenario where minister make policy after consultation. That's our point of departure. And then Treasurer knows that we spend almost a day on this matter. Because yet it's regulations and policy. As far as this bill is concerned, when this bill gets promulgated, regulations will supersede this policy because regulations are subordinate legislation. Hence, Minister will have to consult the Minister of Finance. Now, on each of the policy, as Honorable Delele is raising, is a constitutional matter. When you begin to implement the law gradually, ministers sometimes pronounce directives. Pronounce policy directives. These are the policies to say because there's a shift in terms of area in ICT development, I would love to see this bank reference the objects in clause 2 of this bill. Minister pronounces it a policy. Now, hence we said policy resides with the minister, and he can only make those policies after consulting with the Minister of Finance, not in consultation, because the ICT sector, it is his own terrain. It just happened the post then to operate within that local environment. So it's a constant matter. It's not an issue that we want to give Minister of Communications more power than Minister of Finance. But on regulations, we agree. Regulations, they can be in consultation. These are issues that are within even Treasurer's ambit on sector matters. But on policy matters, I think Minister of Communications can make such pronouncements after consulting Minister of Finance. Thank you, Chairperson.
Kolevani? Okay, take it.
No, I was going to say it will save the DOC and National Treasury the agony of being on each other's throat. Yes. We will make a determination in terms of which one will go to at the right and appropriate time. But we hear their motivation. But we'll finally take a decision around that. They don't have to worry. They make their submission, we understand, but we'll make that determination later, Chair. But, Chair, the issue which I wanted to check was that my understanding, Chair, is that the policies evolve from time to time. You don't make one pronouncement of a policy. Next week it might be something else, things changes and so on. You might have to do some policy and other things and so on. That's why I thought that it's necessary to have the clause because of that matter. We'll come back on that one, Chief, of in all.
Mr. Kolevani is available tomorrow afternoon and Thursday afternoon for lobbying. So any of you between 2 and 4 in the afternoon, he'll be available. Okay. 26 is just cleaning up the language. Okay, as far as I can see. 27, there's nothing. 28, there's nothing except cleaning up the language. 29, on schedule. Okay. Schedule 1 now, because we removed the other schedule. And then the short title is the Post Bank Limited Bill. Okay. Schedules, has anything changed in the schedules? No?
No.
And I take it the memorandum has been amended accordingly. Has the clause of the memorandum been amended also? Where necessary?
No, Chair, I don't. Except if I'm wrong, I don't think we amend those because that bill as introduced,
okay.
And you as the committee will adopt changes, but I'm not sure whether you ever amend the memo.
I'm just asking.
I don't think so, Chair.
Okay. Right, so I think we've done 90% of the work on this bill. There are one or two areas that we will, study groups will go and try and get a mandate on those issues, which might have a bearing on one or two policy issues. But next week we are hoping that we can come and then finalize the amendments and possibly even approve the bill. Provisionally it's on the program for that. But we will keep the parties informed. All the stakeholders. Mr. Kolevani, and then who else wants to speak? CEO?
No, mine is a simple matter. If you check page 29, there are parties consulted there. But I'm interested in the traditional leaders, House of Traditional Leaders. I don't see the Mpumalanga being consulted.
And I've got a vested interest.
Why we do have. But I don't need any lighter notes.
But I'm not interested when I was going to why Mpumalanga has not, the House of Personality has not been listed.
I need 5 minutes of member time. Are you leaving? I know. We're almost done. Okay, so we're working on the assumption that we might be able to complete this bill next week, subject to last-minute consultation by the different caucuses, etc. And we might vote on this next week then. But we'll keep you informed if it's scheduled for next week.
Members, before you leave, there is an invitation that has been issued by ALJAC.
Yeah.
That was circulated. I just need to get a signal from you whether you are agreeable or not, so that we can take a decision on the matter.
The chief technology officer phoned. He wants to invite the committee to come and see the manufacturing plant in somewhere in KZN, and the software application that they have developed and designed, which they say is comparable to anywhere else in the world. Set-top boxes. So they want to invite us at their cost to come and see their own capacity. Jinga and all that. They said, we will show you our capacity. You've been to Brazil, you've seen the capacity, you might have been impressed, but we can show you something also. So I told them that I've got no budget to go to KZN. They said they are prepared to host the committee. And I see there it says 10 members. So if you are agreeable, then we can do the logistics. If you are disagreeable, then I'll tell them, sorry, the committee declines. No, it says we must decide if we want to go. And if we say yes, then we'll find a day in one of the weeks when we can go and visit their plant. Others can leave. That's housekeeping matters. Thank you very much, Dr. Viso and the CEO, Post Office, Finance, DOC. Thank you very much. Ikasa, thank you very much. Then we'll discuss it tomorrow when they're lobbying you, eh?
But you said they must give us something, right? They can't just give us something.
Okay.